Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to Space Junk Podcast. I'm your host, Annie Hanmer, and this week's episode has been an emotional roller coaster to edit. Kane and Tal join me again to unpack the film Interstellar. And my goodness, we did not see COVID coming. This was recorded back before the crisis really hit Australia. And you can totally tell because we talk about the bushfires as if they're the worst thing we'll encounter this decade. And about social isolation and video chat lag as if it's something you'll only experience on a spaceship or inside NORAD. The joke is on us. Kane and Tal do a podcast together called Movies with Kane and Tal, which is fantastic. I highly recommend you go and subscribe right now. The Space Junk Pod is now hosted on Fireside FM. If you have any technical difficulties, please let me know. My email is thespacejunkpodcast@gmail.com. I take that back. It is thespacejunkpod@gmail.com. Or you can find me on Twitter, Insta, or TikTok as @AnnieHanmer. And I realise that saying if you've got technical issues at the front of this episode and then expecting you to know that you have technical issues if you can't access this episode is very complicated and difficult. And unless you can interfere with space-time in the way they do in Interstellar, you're going to struggle. But I will say that episodes generally come out once a week. So if you're not getting one once a week, then do let me know. And finally, if you haven't seen what I'm up to over on YouTube, you should definitely check it out. There are awesome video interviews with space people from around the world going up every day or two. And all of it is presented from my space desk in very loud space-themed attire. I hope you enjoy this episode. It's sort of about Interstellar, but it's mostly about love, life, and the universe.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Okay, then.
Right.
Moving right along. Goodness me, if the ears had walls.
If the ears had walls.
If the ears had walls, indeed. We are back for the next film, Interstellar. People know about Interstellar, right? It's pretty good.
I'm gonna guess that the majority of listeners is probably, particularly if they're in space, have seen this film. So
I imagine so, especially since like Interstellar, in terms of like the last several years worth of movies, like it, along with stuff like Gravity, have like a very very specific place in recent film history because they really did help kickstart this. Well, I'd consider like the more psychiatric space movies, like stuff like The Martian and Ad Astra and even stuff like High Life, in terms of like looking at the real like psychological effects that like space travel and that kind of like, being that far away from home, from everyone you love, can how that affects a person mentally. Mm-hmm. Which I honestly really love about Interstellar because it is all about the strain of relationships across, literally across
space
the boundaries
and
of time and space.
Yeah, look, I watched this, most of this, on a flight, and then I think we were landing or something, and I missed, like, the last 45 minutes. So I'd seen most of the movie and didn't know what happened in the end. So when you messaged him, I was like, Interstellar! Because I needed to see the end of it, and I needed an excuse to sit down and watch a 3-hour movie again.
It is so long.
It's so long.
But it is definitely one of those films that feels like it needs that length, because there is, like, so much being discussed in it. Like, before we even leave Earth, there's so much being discussed in terms of, like, the society that's being built around it. And what we were talking before in terms of, like, you know, Santa Claus comes to Martians having its own form of propaganda. There's a literal propaganda in Interstellar in regards to, like, you know, the Apollo, you know, the moon landing didn't actually happen. It was a ruse just to bankrupt the Soviet Union, which, apart from giving me way too many flashbacks to, you know, having encountered people who say that kind of shit in earnest online, it also, it's a bit like the, like what I discussed with you in regards to the rationale behind the War Boys from Mad Max Fury Road, in terms of, you know, there actually being, like, a proper reason behind that lie being told, because you want, like, if you're in a situation where, you know, the Earth is dying, there isn't enough food, you need people to be, like, mentally planted on Earth, not thinking elsewhere, so just, like, fabricate that we haven't even left Earth yet. Kind of thing.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting, and what, just as a holistic experience for me, having started this podcast with you, Kane, and then you emailed me about wanting to do, have us come on as guests, I said, okay, cool, let's do Interstellar, but I didn't watch it until just this week. In the interim between saying that I wanted to watch Interstellar and then actually watching it, we've had all these apocalyptic events happening in New South Wales. We've had bushfires, we've had floods. And
it really did look like the blight. It really did.
Yeah, like it was this crazy, is the end of the world? No, like it was this really kind of, and I
the
don't
dust
believe
storms
in stuff,
and
yeah,
the, it was
so,
very much like the smoky air that we had.
And so the smoky air, and I couldn't see the mountain. I was telling Kane today, I haven't been able to see the mountain that I could see out from my place for months because it's either been shrouded in smoke or rain cloud. And so in this interim period, I'm watching all this stuff going on, and it reminded me of the beginning of Interstellar, and then it's all kind of finished now, and then I sat down to watch it again and looked at it from that whole kind of, like, I really put myself in that imagine that we got to the point. Are we fucking up the planet badly enough that at some point we're going to get to there? Like, I sort of started thinking, I'm always an optimist, always. I always believe that we'll find a way to figure stuff out. But lately, very lately, between that, watching first half of that film and then watching the rest of it, I've started to think to myself, I'm not sure we can figure this out. I don't know if we're taking the right steps. And I don't know if that's really not actually out of the realms of possibility in the near future.
Hey guys, Annie here, just jumping in quickly to say that when we recorded this, it was just after the bushfires and the floods in Australia and before COVID-19 really hit us. And so in that context, this particular section has a cruel kind of irony to it in that we thought we were through the worst of things. How wrong we were. Anyway, now I will get back to Kane.
Which is also kind of fascinating because in regards to, like I said before, the psychiatric kind of space movie. One of the other main threads in that is that in terms of showing space as, like, the kind of environment where we need to band together in order to survive, Interstellar itself is a very optimistic movie. As much as it is, you know, filled with so much, you know, misery, people are dying, the Earth is dying, we need to find somewhere else. There is so much about it that really feels like, that, you know, Christopher and Jonathan Nolan, who wrote the script together, truly believe that, well, you know, it'll all work out in the end. Because, well, and honestly, the main argument I have for that would be this film's version of artificial intelligence with the TARS and CASE robots, which back when I first watched this in cinemas when it first came out and now, is still one of my favorite robot designs ever. They're almost like Jenga blocks. They're rather rudimentary. And especially with, like, it's not just that they're programmed with sense of humor, honesty, empathy, but degrees of which.
Yeah, the parameters can be flexed. I mean, that's such a clever concept, isn't it?
It really is, especially since, like, in regards to AI in, you know, space movies, like with the golden standard, HAL 9000 from 2001 Space Odyssey, that is easily like the worst case scenario, like the worst of humanity turned into machinery that basically just screws us over.
Sure.
Whereas with this, with, you know, the Case and TARS robots, that's easily the most optimistic, because it shows that, you know, actually giving, you know, artificial life this level of, you know, intelligence, not just like strict mental intelligence, but emotional intelligence as well, isn't going to completely screw us over in the long run. If anything, it's going to be more of a boon to us than we realize.
Yeah, I felt it was like drawing on the tradition of HAL, but also potentially incorporating a little bit of Star Wars with C-3PO and R2-D2 and their kind of...
Yes, and...
The quirkiness.
I take it you've heard of the Turing test, right? The artificial intelligence test to tell if it actually is sentient. Well, it's a subset of that called Ebert's Law, named after Roger Ebert, which is basically the same idea, except it's with how you prove an artificial intelligence has a sense of humor.
Right.
That kind of thing. And especially with like the conversations between the robot and Matthew McConaughey's Cooper, in terms of like, you know, they're constantly making jokes. You want me to turn down the humor setting if you're going to keep doing this? Like that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very quirky in that way. I want to cut in the trailer. So we'll do that now.
A little late, Coop.
Yeah, we had a flag.
It's an Indian surveillance drone. Solar cells power an entire farm.
What'd you do, Murph?
She didn't do nothing.
Murphy's Law.
You're a well-educated man, Coop. And a trained pilot.
And an engineer.
The world doesn't need any more engineers. We didn't run out of planes and television sets. We ran out of food.
Dad, why did you name me after something that's bad?
Oh, we didn't.
Murphy's Law.
Murphy's Law doesn't mean that something bad will happen. It means that whatever can happen will happen.
We must confront the reality that nothing in our solar system can help us.
Now you need to tell me what your plan is to save the world.
We're not meant to save the world. We're meant to leave it. And this is the mission we were trained for.
I've got kids, Professor.
Get out there and save them.
I have no idea when you're coming back.
I'm coming back.
We must reach far beyond our own lifespans. We must think not as individuals, but as a species. We must confront the reality of interstellar travel.
Murph, I love you forever.
I first saw this film when it came out, and I watched it in IMAX, the Darling Harbour one, before it got knocked down. For international listeners, it was like the biggest screen in the Southern Hemisphere. It was amazing. I saw it in 3D in IMAX in the middle of the back row, like the night it came out or something. I don't know how I just did. And I was so blown away by it and how incredible the visuals were. The soundtrack, it was just this most amazing film that I went back and saw it again twice in that 1 week in IMAX in 3D. So I kind of, because I had that thing, I think that it made a bit of an emotional impact on me. And so I always tend to forgive some of the stuff in it because I think it's still a great movie. But I know that some people I've spoken to, especially in the space community, take issue with bits of the science that aren't quite right or things like that.
But didn't they, I mean, they consulted with someone, right?
It was Kip Thorne, I think. So,
yeah.
The same person who was the main consultant on Contact with Jodie Foster, like that 90s right. movie, which honestly, in terms of like hard science, the ending is just as jarring in terms of just like, whoa, what the hell's going on?
So I actually have a great claim to fame here, which is that I have met Kip Thorne and Kane just like almost spat his water across the table. So through my brother, who's a theoretical physicist and was doing his PhD at Caltech, around the time that Interstellar came out, I found myself at a barbecue at Kip Thorne's house. Sat in his kitchen and had a chat to him about the making of the film. And I also went in his, he has a swimming pool and a spa. And I was also in his swimming pool and spa.
Oh my
many
God.
Years ago.
Damn.
So, so it was a pretty interesting experience. And speaking to Kip Thorne, well, first of all, he's really cool and I really like him. And secondly, he has an awesome house and like it has a pool and a spa. And thirdly, I think for him being involved in the making of this film was really a labor of love. And
it's with him that the whole idea of the movie started.
Well, and it turns out that he was really keen to do the visualization of what it would be like to go into a black hole. And doing that was really expensive because you need a bunch of software to visualize it.
I think that the official number was like something crazy, like 800 terabytes of data were used just to render everything.
So he was like, I want to do this thing. And so basically found a movie project and built the movie around this moment where you see what it looks like to go into the black hole. And they visualize the whole black hole and all of that stuff on the screen in 3D. And so for him, that was his focus. He was really interested in that. But he had a great involvement with the rest of the film as well and all of the science in it. And he actually released a book called The Science of Interstellar, which you can read if you're interested.
It is very interesting.
But he said that one of his highlights was working with Anne Hathaway, who apparently studied up so much for her role that she had the equivalent of a Caltech bachelor's degree in physics by the time they finished filming, which he thought was pretty impressive.
It's very
sounds almost tame for method acting compared to like some of the like really out there
right,
like, stuff.
Yeah.
But at the same time,
she didn't go and live in the wilderness for 10 years, like eating only the leaves that he pulled from the yurt or something like that. Yeah, but it's still pretty cool.
And the visuals definitely are like the main, as far as I'm concerned, the main selling point behind the whole thing. Main initial selling point because the effects studio behind this, Double Negative, had done a lot of work with Christopher Nolan in the past. They're the same people who did Inception, so like the city folding itself in half kind of effect that's kind of echoed here.
Mm.
That was them. And in terms of like really like breaking the walls of reality, well, like these guys really know their stuff. They're the same studio that did a lot of work on Doctor Strange, which is all about like imposing one's will on reality and changing it as they see fit, which Double Negative seems to be all over, especially with like how like expansive and just kind of like mind-bending the visuals actually are, to the point where I'm both disappointed and thankful that I didn't see it in IMAX because for one, I would have gotten the full effect of it. But on the other hand, it really felt like if I saw that on the biggest screen possible, it would actually like get to me like too much. Like like we're in a little mini Cthulhu moment.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Overload. No, all I meant was I love the film. I love the characters. I love the story. I love the connection between them, the dialogue, everything about it for me, in fact, so much to the point that I didn't really notice the visuals that much. Like I didn't focus much on it. I didn't look at it and go, oh wow, look how they've depicted space here, like at all.
Right. It is a film that I think has a very strong emotional through line.
Yeah.
And it is one of the only films that consistently makes me tear up, I've got to say.
Same here, honestly. And that's why I'm correcting myself with the initial selling point. Because for me, my favorite scenes were just like Cooper and Murph, you know, getting these, you know, time delayed messages from each other, which like that's really heartbreaking. The idea that this like I was literally only gone for an hour in my time, and like so many years have passed.
Yeah.
It actually reminded me of this this anime that I watched like years and years ago called Voices of a Distant Star, which is basically the same idea as this. It's like a short 20-minute film about this guy and a girl, where the girl is like this mecha pilot who has to fight like an intergalactic war, and they text message each other across space and time. So it's like she sends a message 10 years later, he gets it back on Earth kind of thing, and just that emotional disconnect. Like, it's almost like making a trip like that requires a form of like emotional deadness. Like with Matt Damon's sudden appearance.
Yeah.
But like the idea of just like, you know, the less like tangible connections you have with the Earth, the less likely it is for kind of, you know, the social isolation, like space madness to kick in. Which admittedly the film itself debunks in regards to how Matt Damon turns out, but...
Well, they all go a little bit, you know, a little bit crazy in their own way at certain points, except maybe Anne Hathaway's character, who's, I've got to say, like, remarkably solid. And I can't, every time I see her in a film, I can't help but think of The Devil Wears Prada and her fabulous role in that, which... having watched more recently is quite problematic in some of its messaging around relationships and women and so on. However, however, I did think there was one line she said where she was saying that, what was it? Oh, I can't find it. Oh no, she was like, time can't move backwards. It just can't. Mm-hmm. And I was so reminded of her like trying to tell Miranda that like, you know, I can't do it. There isn't time. I can't stop the storm. And I was like, you know what? Try harder. You're not trying, Andy. Anyway, I loved her in this. I thought there was this weird thing about the sacrificial daughters that I noticed in this watch. I know there's that trope of the girlfriend in the freezer.
Yep.
In film, you know, the
fridging,
yes, fridging. So this idea that you have to have like something bad happen to a woman you love
in order to give the man an impetus to do something.
And the one film I would say that does that and is still my favorite film of all time is John Wick.
Oh yeah, well admittedly, unless you actively want to, you know, the I guess the logical conclusion of that is just the idea that, you know, bitches need to get hurt for the man to do something.
Mm, right.
But at the same time...
that's what you and Ben talked about also in...
But in this film, you have instead this idea of the daughter. You've got the professor's daughter, played by Anne Hathaway, Brand, and you've got Murphy. And in both cases, the father kind of, like, sacrifices them.
Mm.
And in the professor's case, he does it without emotion. Like, all of his messages to his daughter are basically just like, let me read you a poem. Did you think about science today? Like, it's so emotionless. And it's that idea of that the scientist who wears a white coat and is so separated from any emotion, which is a motif that isn't necessarily accurate. And then you've got the contrast of this, like, really difficult anger and resentment and love that crosses dimensions between Murphy and her father.
And Gambit's part was talking about before in regards to, like, you know, the optimism behind this whole
thing.
That very idea of just, like, you know, love is the only thing that can travel across space and time at the speed at which it does, that's an incredibly idealistic way of looking at the raw mechanics of space travel. And, well... I would say it's not the most accurate thing in the world, but then again, I genuinely think that Double Negative did literal magic with this, considering they managed to portray a fifth-dimensional space on a two-dimensional plane with the ending.
Okay, yes. Or three-dimensional if you saw it at IMAX.
Well, yeah.
But, I do have a problem with this. Love is the only thing that can transcend time and space and travel across, because, like, hate can do that too. There is nothing love can do that a strong hatred can't.
Yeah, admittedly, to quote my personal favourite space writer, Douglas Adams, the only thing that can travel faster than the speed of light is bad news, which tends to obey its own special laws.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Or gossip.
Yeah, well, pretty much, same sort of thing. Yeah, look, I think that I would really like to get into some of the science with this with you, because
yeah.
there are some questions that I would like to ask about the film. But on Kane's point about the optimism, I think that's probably, like what I said before, I am the eternal optimist. It's one of my fatal flaws, but I think that's probably why this movie appealed to me so much.
And probably the same for me as well.
Yeah, like I don't think I could have sat through 3 hours of a film that didn't have the hope in it, that felt hopeless
yes.
the whole way through.
And especially with like how recursive that hope ends up being, especially when it gets to the ending, we see just how much bootstrapping plays into the plot itself.
Mm.
Which I have to admit, considering it came out the same year as like Predestination, which is even more heavy on the bootstrapping and the time travel, just absolute wonkiness. I honestly really like, because bootstrapping itself is just such a fundamentally human idea, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of just like, you know, we literally bring ourselves into these situations.
Mm-hmm.
We're the ones backing ourselves into these incredibly surreal situations.
Mm-hmm.
And again, especially with how it was visualized, like this whole, like corridors built on corridors of this one room, this one moment extrapolated forever. It really is a kind of mind expanding idea that could only work through the map, through the wizardry of CGI, quite frankly.
It is fascinating. It the Tesseract at the end is what
yeah.
we're describing. And I so I initially had issues with that because I was like, okay, but like, why the bedroom? And then, as my wonderful brother pointed out to me, well, if you're talking about a future civilization that has the capacity to build and install a convenient wormhole, then like, why can't they make a Tesseract that has this, you know, the kid's bedroom in it? Like, that probably makes sense. And I was like, actually, that's a really good point. In fact, I think Neil deGrasse Tyson said something along those lines as well. At the same time, I can see that it's a bit of a deus ex machina to be like, oh yes, but future humans are just brilliant.
But at the same time, it was foreshadowed, because remember, right at the start, young Merv comes into the parents' bedroom and actually says to Cooper, I thought you were the ghost.
Mm.
Mm.
Like, right, or like, that's...
Oh,
what,
yeah.
So,
yeah,
yeah. It's not something like really pulled out of nowhere.
It's Chekhov's ghost right up front there.
Exactly.
But yeah, and that's I think that's the difference between, and we discuss this all the time, a properly thought out script and a properly thought out story. All those visuals, all those special effects, all these ideas, all these concepts presented in a film won't work unless you have a nice cohesive story to go along with it. Unfortunately, that's just the reality. It doesn't matter how good your CGI is. It doesn't matter how great the acting is.
Mm.
If the story doesn't draw people in, and if it doesn't make sense, if you can't get to the end of it and go, oh, okay, like it had its beginning, its middle, and its end, and our characters went through their arcs that they needed to go through, and everybody was resolved at the end, none of that other stuff means anything. So for me, from a movie perspective, non-scientific, non-CGI, non-special effects, non-visuals, this film works for me because it's a beautiful story. There's great character interaction. And yeah, with everything that's been going on lately, and as a parent as well, like looking at that kind of scenario, that situation of feeling like, I don't know what decision I would make in that situation. Would I go off for the off chance that I could save my kids and miss out on them growing up? Or would I stay home? I think I'd have to say, as a parent, I would have stayed.
Mm.
Because, and I would have been like, I think this should be somebody else's responsibility, and my responsibility is to my children.
I think that is the most heartbreaking point of the film for me, when he's in the Tesseract and he's yelling to Merv
stay.
And he's like, make him stay, don't let me go, let me go.
She tried, and that whole thing of like parents not listening to kids, like that really got me when she goes, you don't believe me.
Yeah.
And he just gets up and he just goes.
Yeah.
He doesn't, like, we think that children, and this comes to your point that you make all the time about making children's films, thinking that children will just swallow anything, that like kids don't understand things. They do.
Yeah.
And but we don't listen to them.
Mm.
We're still not listening to them. You know, whether you agree with Greta Thunberg or not, there are people who are not listening. The people are shutting her down because she's, quote unquote, a 16-year-old girl.
And well, I'm going to say I'm the only person who can actively say this and be like, oh, she's just a retarded globalist puppet, and yep. like said by people who have even less free will of speech to even come up with their own arguments, but whatever.
Well, exactly.
Sure.
And So there's all this.
But it goes back to that Santa Claus conquers the Martian view of childhood, which yeah. is that, you know, you should just be playing with toys and watching TV.
Seen and not heard. And that's what was interesting, what you said about the post-war thing. I mean, you know, it wasn't that long ago that parents were told not to love their children. Parents were told that love was weak and to show love to your kids was a bad thing to do.
But children died a lot as well. I mean, we always forget that the mortality rate for children was insane.
But it wasn't so much about protecting the parents. It was about protecting the children. If you love your children too much, you're going to coddle them and they won't be able to get on in life. And we've now debunked a lot of that stuff, and we treat our children differently than we did in the 1940s and the 1900s.
Yeah,
you know,
it's almost like love actually does have a certain scientific principle behind it.
Right.
So in light of that, what this film has to say isn't as ridiculous, but then again, considering in terms of all the theoretical physics that basically make up the core of this movie in regards to, gravity being able to travel across time, you know, even comprehending the idea of being able to, like, move and shape fifth dimensional space into, you know, stuff like the Tesseract, or even just like visualizing the inside of the black hole and all of its incredibly bizarre, like, again, it is a kind of that cosmic horror, you can't comprehend what you're seeing kind of aspect to it, because it, and that's actually something like inherent to all manner of film, because it's always a two-dimensional display for the most part, once you watch, like, you know, IMAX 3D cinema. You know, three-dimensional space captured on a two-dimensional plane. And in that regard, being able to actually get across the idea of, you know, third, fourth, fifth on that plane, like, it is one of the situations where I would have to disagree with you in regards to if they didn't have a good story. It doesn't matter how good the CGI is, because this is like prime best of the entire decade kind of material. Kind of the same reaction I have in regards to, like, Doctor Strange. It's just an added bonus that it is as much of a tearjerker as it is, because, oh my god, it really is, like, so fucking depressing watching Matthew McConaughey, like, watching his daughter grow up in between messages and just being, like, you know, hearing about, you know, his son growing up, son having a kid, kid not surviving. I see what you mean by the sacrificial daughters aspect. And just, yeah, like, especially when, like, what you were saying in regards to, like, you know, hate, you know, travel as far as love, despair and loneliness travel as much as that. Like, the whole, you know, emotional spectrum can travel just as far as any of its components. And in regards to that, there is something a bit, there is something quite poignant about the idea of just, like, you know, in the few seconds it takes to, you know, flick a screen off and on again, you know, someone very close to you could have aged into dust in that instant.
Could they? Can you explain this to me? Is that real?
The time thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So,
is this a theoretical thing, or has this been proven?
Okay, I'm going to flag right here that I'm not a physicist.
What? God, what are we doing here, Kate? Pack up your stuff.
I do.
You're supposed to give me all the answers.
I do know some things about it through. I sometimes say I, like, speak science as a second language because I grew up around theoretical physicists. But the whole relativity of time is a thing. I believe it has been proven, and it's also a theory. There are some aspects. So for the most part, my understanding is the science in this film is pretty good.
Okay.
And I think it's actually a real testament to the film that it gets so much right that people quibble over the edges of it.
It's all like the ice clouds.
Yeah, like things like that where they're like, you know, oh, well, I'm going to quibble over, like, the specifics of, like, the singularity and where it sits within the black hole. And it's like, this is, it's just incredible to me that a blockbuster film can have nerds on the internet And I consider myself one of them, having these conversations. It's
well,
fantastic.
Well, basically the same kind of conversations pop up when it comes to like, well, just about any movie now.
True.
It's because arguing is now an international sport.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I actually ran into a weird situation in regards to The Martian, when it comes to like scientific accuracy. Like that scene where Matt Damon's visor gets cracked and
mm-hmm.
he literally like tapes it up with duct tape. I watched that in the cinema and I went, there's no way that actually works. And then I've read up and actually, yes, that would work.
Yeah. So I think, okay, so with the science, the thing that I really do get in this film, and I've got to say, it's a movie that challenges me in terms of my understanding of all of this stuff, which I also love because you watch so many movies that shy away from complexity.
Yeah.
I mean, even something like The Big Short, completely different scenario, but a movie that tries to explain complex concepts.
Mm-hmm.
There are some aspects of derivative trading that movie just is like, nah. It's like, oh, it's too complicated. We're not going to bother with it. And it's like, I wish that it did bother with it because it's not so complicated that it can't be explained.
Mm-hmm.
And with this film, I feel as though the areas that were so complicated that they weren't explained well are so complicated that Kip Thorne even isn't quite sure. And so these are the like very boundaries of our theories about relativity and about dimensions and about all of the way that these things work. I think with the wormholes, the way that they explained wormholes was great. I mean, that is a direct borrow from A Wrinkle in Time, which
mm-hmm.
is the famous sci-fi book by Madeleine L'Engle.
Fair enough. Although, admittedly, I will say that Interstellar is a better use of that, of pretty much anything from A Wrinkle in Time than the actual Wrinkle in Time movie.
Oh, the movie. Don't bother with the movie. I'm talking about the books.
Right.
I'm a nerd, Kane.
Fair enough. Absolutely fair enough. And in regards to, you know, being able to portray, like, you know, the wormhole, you know, the logistics of the wormhole with the, you know, two dots and a piece of paper, it's a very Carl Sagan way of explaining it, like being able to boil it down to its purest elements, which is somewhat fitting considering Kip Thorne and the producer he worked with directly in this film's embryonic stage, they met because Carl Sagan put them together on a blind date.
Yeah. So
in its own way, we have him to thank for this as well.
But in a way that a lot of it is explained, it goes back to that way that we explain things to kids in high school or primary school science classes.
Well, we aren't telling them the moon landing is fake.
Right. I mean, you know, that's... But see, that's really fascinating because people say, well, isn't it dreadful that we're teaching kids things in science class that's incorrect? Well, we do that all the time. Like, we do that now. I was taught... I went to a great school and my textbooks were out of date and I was taught models of what atoms look like that were not up to date with the current thought, scientific thought at the time. And I remember coming home and doing my science homework and my brother had a friend over who was a friend of his from the physics Olympiads that he competed in. And they were like looking at my textbook and laughing and being like, oh my God, it's like 20 years out of date with the major theories. But the view was, okay, well, we'll just teach them this because it's easy to teach them this. And I still think that, you know, this is in Sydney, right? This is Sydney with me growing up not that long ago. Whereas if you look at what happens in the US where people are taught creation science and and everything else and the rampant amounts of homeschooling. In fairness, Murphy also seems to end up getting homeschooled by that random professor as like a prisoner inside NORAD in the mountain, which is a bit
weird. Well, considering all the stuff to do with the blights and just like, you know, being above ground probably isn't the best idea.
I mean, yeah, but with the black hole. So the wormhole I thought was spectacular rendering, loved that. The black hole, there's this quote in the movie which I wrote down because it was just like so stupid, but delightfully so, which was if the black hole is an oyster, the singularity is the pearl inside.
Right, yeah.
A little oversimplistic.
Which is oversimplistic to the point of being like, what are you trying to get at here?
Yeah.
I had a chat with my brother about it and he was saying that since the film was made, there's actually more theory that has emerged and more evidence that's emerged to suggest that there isn't just one singularity in the middle of a black hole. There might be one there, but you'd actually get blocked from getting there by further singularities. So there'd be three on the way in, if that makes sense.
I'm out now.
We haven't even got to dimensions. I have a great description for dimensions.
Yeah, and the thing with like Interstellar is that it's not like the hardest science in regards to sci-fi, but it is a lot harder than usual, especially when it comes to like, you know, stuff like Star Trek, which somehow think that, you know, like stuff like Event Horizons are things you can actually fight against because they're a physical thing and not just an aspect of physics that doesn't work that way. But the main thing that I think honestly surprised me the most about this is such a simple thing, and it's such a staple of science fiction right across the board. Sound in space. There isn't any. And Interstellar is like one of the few movies that actually goes along with it, because being ultra stylized and having like engine sounds is a lot more engaging than just the silence. But it actively does make some of the scenes, especially the scene of like McConaughey like hurtling towards the black hole that leads into the Tesseract. Like that moment where it's just like all you can hear is his breathing, and even that's being warped by the gravity stretches.
But I assumed that was his own hearing of his breathing inside his suit.
Well, exactly. And it's the only sound that we actually get.
Right, I see what you mean.
Whereas with, you know, like so many other movies and TV shows as well, they always do like portray like, you know, the vacuum of space as if it can actually carry sound, which in some cases has been stretched so far, like with Jupiter Ascending, where it had that whole plot point about like this half man, half dog alien creature who can actually smell through the vacuum of space. Where that kind of crap.
Okay.
And so even in regards to this, you know, not being the hardest, you know, not being the strictest, this is how reality actually works, science fiction. Just through those little touches, like the somewhat rudimentary makeup of the TARS and CASE robots, as well as the lack of sound in space. It's all the little things that give it a bit more, you know, reality.
I might be getting this wrong, but the robots, they're meant to be old because haven't they stopped making new ones? Like, hasn't like technology on planet Earth kind of come to a standstill, except for the secret NASA station. So these are robots from like 20 years ago, right?
I love that they gave that to the conspiracy theorists and were like, yeah, there is a secret NASA and they're working underground. I was like, yeah.
So that's done on purpose, right? They're trying to show that like outside of this secret space thing, there's been no real advances in technology for a while, except for farming.
Well, the same is true with rockets. Our rockets today are very much the same as our rockets have ever been. They just look prettier. But the tech itself hasn't really developed particularly much. Okay. It's kind of the same technology that made missiles originally. You just chuck a big explosion on the end of something and it goes somewhere. You know, leave something behind. The whole thing where they like jettison the stuff to get out. It's the physics of the rocket.
Speaking of the physics of the rocket,
yeah,
the let's spin as fast as the space station thing.
Yeah. Oh, that was epic.
Is that even remotely plausible?
I don't know, and I'm not going to say yes or no. However, it reminded me of the maneuver that was done in
The Fast and the Furious? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, where they're chucking the donuts. Yeah. No, it was the one in The Right Stuff.
Oh, right.
Where there was this spinning spacecraft and they had to dock with it. And it was spinning, and so they had to spin really fast to dock with it, which I think is based on like actual truth thing that happened. So the concept of matching the spin of something in order to dock is very much a thing we do, and we do that all the time, like with stuff in orbit. The thing was spinning really fast, and I think, like, for me, the point of that wasn't, is this possible, but more what Matthew McConaughey's character said when he said, well, it's not possible, it's necessary, which is that idea that under the right circumstances, humans are capable of doing pretty cool stuff because otherwise they're dead. So they're kind of just like, well, we don't want to die. I guess we will match the spin and deal with it.
And isn't that what...
And Anne Hathaway's character like passes out because that's what happens when you spin really fast.
Yeah.
And isn't that what...
Unless you're younger than 10, in which case you just keep going.
Isn't that kind of Matt Damon's character's point?
Yeah. Yeah, the survival instinct thing.
That's... particularly people who have something for like a child or a
voiced by someone who himself is kind of like the worst case scenario for survival instinct in terms of just my survival over anyone else's.
Okay, so this is my fundamental problem with this movie. I like this movie. I will watch it. It's emotional. It gets me. It's visually beautiful. The science is pretty good. It's a good time. But I take extreme issue with the notion, like the fundamental basis of the film, which is that humans, like the best scenario for humans at any point will be to leave Earth and go somewhere else. The idea that that if we fuck up Earth enough, that it's okay because science will save us and we will find a way to defeat gravity briefly to get off the Earth and like take the survivors there.
Move to another planet, drain it of its resources.
Exactly.
Move to another planet and the cycle.
And also, and it's that whole thing about like, you know, human beings were born on planet Earth, but we were never meant to die here. It's like, no, maybe we were, but also that doesn't excuse us from trying to not fuck up Earth in the first place.
Well, it's almost exactly the same as the whole, you know, but idea also that there'll be a day of reckoning in one day. Those of us who have done the right thing will be taken to the good place and the rest of us will be left here to burn.
But also this idea of this manifest destiny of human beings as a species, that we need to ensure our continued survival to the extent that we'll send embryos to a random planet, that somehow this is the right answer. And I just don't buy it. Like, I just think...
But it wouldn't make for a very interesting movie if they just fixed everything on Earth.
But it's a real thing. It's just what the billionaires in Silicon Valley think about. They're I'm going to save my genetics.
That was actually, like, a key plot point in Ad Astra from last year in regards to, like, you know, we're trying to, you know, leave Earth and ostensibly its problems behind and move forward. But, you know, all the, you know, global, you know, interstellar shifting in the world doesn't really shake the fact that we are an inherently self-destructive, selfish,
shitty,
fucked up species.
Or are we? I mean, I think it's really amazing to me the way that we always try and justify or critique our behavior in reference to saying that we are a certain thing as a species. I mean, maybe we're not anything. We just are. We just exist, and that's that. And we do stuff. It doesn't mean that we have a nature behind us. Tal's mind is blown.
And that's the thing about nature, and one of the things that, you know, kind of gets lost in translation when it comes to, especially with stuff like, you know, climate change and stuff like that. Like, there's this notion that, like, you know, nature actively has something against us, which...
Right, that we're fighting nature.
Which admittedly does have some basis in reality because, well, that's how we have anything that we can lay claim to. We altered the natural world in order to create, well, everything from this bowl of chips and the microphone we're using to record this. Our existence is owed to fighting against nature.
Or is it owed to working with nature? Like I'm not critiquing, right? But you've got to give me this because I'm a philosopher of science. If you look at the history of science, there's this move to characterize nature as the female. And then if you look at the scientific narrative, it's like it's one of abuse against nature. It's like we're peeling back the layers, we're taking off her clothes, we're seeing what's underneath. It's this very kind of rapey vibe. And I do.
Well, it's been used. It's used
to rape the man. I honestly haven't thought about it in those terms before. But yeah.
How do you feel?
I think I'm
not going to be able to think of that in that regard.
But it is totally a thing. And I think when we think about fighting against nature as humans, what we're actually thinking about is a more recent colonial mindset.
I was about to say, this is a very Western
Yeah, it's that thing of we're explorers, we're pioneers, yeah. I mean, really, they're saying we're colonists. Our job is to colonize. We go places and spread our.
And admittedly, that's like my in regards to, you know, us fighting against nature. I don't necessarily see it, well, up until a few seconds ago, I didn't see it in regards to that. But I saw it as more of what sentient thought allows a species. Like, non-sentient life forms just see what is. Sentient life forms like us see what could be. Like, it's being able to look at, you know, the empty plane that this building was standing in was, and going, what could we turn this into?
But just because you can do something, does that mean you should?
Well, yeah, exactly.
And this movie seems to say, yeah, it seems to say not only should, like, not only is it okay to do what you're capable of doing, like, to the very edge of your capability, but in fact, you have an obligation to do it. And it's your destiny, and you must. And the future humans have made this possible by putting the wormhole there. Therefore, this is what we must do.
Sure.
It's like everything, all of the everything is justified on the basis that they managed to solve the issue of
gravity. And so much of it is predicated on lies as well. And this is something that, like, that regularly...
Oh, no, he means
In terms of, like, you know, the scientist who, you know, kept information from his daughter, along with the, you know, faked Apollo landing, you know, stuff back on Earth. And that's something that is kind of consistent in Christopher Nolan's filmography. Like, all of his films in some way involve, like, how much easier it is to accept a kind of, you know, comfortable lie than an uncomfortable truth. Like, with The Dark Knight and how that ended, The Prestige, which is all about trickery, right down to Inception's ending, where we literally do not know what is truth. Except with this, it actively, like, looked at how many people were lying, including Matt Damon's character in regards to the data he accumulated.
Right.
And still went, No, we can't just accept this. And especially when it got to the point of them going, we can't allow not just ourselves, but our people, our species, to die. We're not going to just go quietly into that good night.
Very good.
Mm.
I had one...
Please go on.
One kind of final thing to talk about.
Mm.
So the one thing that I... absolutely hate about this movie is the moment when Murph discovers the answer to gravity and then throws her papers everywhere shouting Eureka and then kisses her random friend.
Yeah.
And I was like, dude, this is not part of the story.
No.
We don't give a shit about this guy. He's just like some doctor that she knows.
Well, they're Topher Grace, which means extra not caring.
Right. She's fucking awesome and intelligent and like solved the problem of gravity. And now you're going to like make her kiss someone just so you can show that she's heteronormative. Like,
a single woman? No, we must pair her with someone at the end for no reason other than they need to be.
Don't even get me started on this shit.
If you just cut that scene.
Yeah.
Much better film.
Would be.
Yeah.
You're right about, fortunately, there's so much going for this movie that you can forgive a few of these little things. That one is borderline unforgivable, but I guess I'm just so used to it now. Just this, the way we treat female characters in film.
There's a reason why I keep railing against stuff like fridging and, you know, the convenient last minute setup. Especially like the third act breakup where it's like, oh no, I'm away from my man. I'm so sad.
Right. Yeah.
Let single people be, please. Right. And merely all three of us, from my understanding, are in relationships. But at the same time.
Yeah. It's just... It's the downplay that comes behind a move like that.
Mm.
The downplaying of her character, like you're saying, that in order for her, for that moment to be fulfilled for her, she needs to somehow express something to the male standing next to her is just weird. I mean, I feel like she wouldn't have even barely noticed he was there. She would have just been like, this is such an incredible point in my life. Why on earth would you?
Or they could have just isn't this great?
Emotional brains, it's all that controls them.
Yeah,
and in the moment of their emotion, the first thing they want to do is kiss some random.
And actually, that was part of my problem with Anne Hathaway's character as well, in that she's the one on the spaceship who presents the idea. The woman presents the idea that love is a good enough reason as any, that emotion, you know, and that love can travel through time and space. I was like, well, if we'd had one of the guys saying that.
Would you really buy it from Matthew McConaughey, though? Like, he's really good at being the everyman. I'm not so sure he's good at being able to deliver something that pinpoint idealistic.
Sure, it does. My point is, it's just, for me, I was a bit like, I did roll my eyes a little bit. Also, of course, that idea would have to come from a woman because a woman would act on emotion and not science, even though she's a fucking scientist. And she's on a spaceship on a mission to save the
planet.
And
she's like,
but she's
totally
decided to go and see
her
boyfriend.
She's like, oh, I'm going to go see my boyf. Yeah, it wasn't okay.
That wasn't
the best. But, you know, it's been a few years since this film came out and I like to think that things will improve.
Yeah.
I think it's unlikely.
No,
it was better than, like, most films of this sort.
Totally. Yeah, I'll give it
that. Still is, even with the trend that's kicked up in regards to stuff like Martian and High Life. Every time I say that, I just keep thinking about how much High Life might be the single horniest space opera. Like, it's such a goddamn weird movie. It really is.
I haven't seen it. I'll have to. Yeah.
I think we're going to have to finish up.
Yeah.
So, look, concluding thoughts. They were both interesting movies.
For different reasons.
If I had to pick one to watch, I'd probably watch Interstellar over Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Mm-hmm,
however, no, that's it. That's all I want to say on that one. But I really enjoyed doing this. Thank you much for making the time and coming and being on the pod.
Absolutely.
And if people want to find more of your brilliant work and your excellent reviews, they should search up Movies with Kane and Tal.
Yep.
And if for some reason us rambling for 30-40 minutes isn't nearly enough, I have, of course, the over 1,000 reviews at Mahan's Media. Just Google MAHAN's Media and you'll find my last five, nearly 6 years worth of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And at which includes a review for Interstellar, where I go into a bit more detail, although admittedly I wrote that during like my first couple months of blogging, so it's not nearly as refined as it's gotten me nowadays. But if you guys want to check out more of my stuff, feel free to drop down to my neck of the woods.
Right, you heard it here first. Go and check out Mahan's Media and read some of those excellent reviews that Kane's written. And Tal, any projects you want to plug?
Oh, no. Just Movies with Kane and Tal.
Just the pod.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Space Junk. If you enjoyed this podcast, head over to Kane and Tal's regular podcast, Movies with Kane and Tal. You can also find them on Twitter as @MoviesWithKaneAndTal.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.